Okay, so we are going to begin with the Chumash. Let me get the Chumash up. Second. This week there is a double Sedra, and we are looking at Kedoshim, the second Sedra. So, one second. So we are looking at the second Sedra, which begins here. Now, so let's just look at this first verse. First couple of verses. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe lem. God spoke to Moses, saying, "Dabel kol adat bnei Yisrael, speak to all the congregation of the children of Israel, va'amata alehem, and you should say to them, Kadoshim tiyu, you should be holy, ki kadosh ani Hashem elokechem, because I, God, your Lord, am holy." Now, the question is, the question which is asked by various commentators is, what is this instruction to be holy? What most parts of Torah law are very specific and clear practical laws. What exactly is meant by this law, you should be holy? So Rashi comments that what this is referring to are the previous section of the Torah. Now, the previous section of the Torah is also part of this week's Sedra, because this week's Sedra is a double Sedra. And I'm just going to the beginning of this section. Just looking at this in English. You should not copy the practices of the land of Egypt. Now, Maimonides, the Rambam, discusses what is meant by the practices of the land of Egypt. He says what they did in Egypt, a man would marry a man and a woman would marry a woman. So here the Torah is telling us that you're not allowed to do that. Now, then we have prohibition on incest, not come near anyone of one's own flesh, the nakedness of one's mother, of one's father's wife, of one's sister, one's son's daughter, one's daughter's daughter, and all of these are prohibitions on intimacy, the father's. So interestingly, one isn't allowed to marry one's aunt in Jewish law, but one can marry one's uncle. So one's father's sister is prohibited, but one's father's brother is permitted, unlike in English law. It goes on speaking about various people, a woman and her daughter, not to marry two sisters, to keep away from a woman during one's wife during menstruation, not to have relations, not to commit adultery, in other words, with one's neighbor's wife, not to serve idols, not to lie with a male, not to have carnal relations with a beast. And a woman shouldn't do that either. These are the laws which precede our Sedra. So then comes our Sedra saying, you should be holy. So according to Rashi, what you should be holy means is the preceding passage, keeping away from all these sexual sins, and that is how one gets holiness. Now, another possible interpretation is that it's not talking about the previous passage, it's talking about the future passage, because there are many very beautiful laws which are in the following verses. For example, each person, each man should revere their mother and their father. And it goes on with various other laws, leaving fruit for the poor. You shouldn't take all the fruit from your vineyard, leave some for the poor. You shouldn't steal, shouldn't be deceitful, shouldn't swear falsely by God's name. You shouldn't defraud your fellow. I don't know why they only write Israelite here. You're not allowed to defraud any human being. You shouldn't commit robbery. You have to pay a laborer on time. You shouldn't put a stumbling block before the blind, which Rashi explains as giving bad advice. You shouldn't give unfair decisions in the law courts, nor favor the poor and nor the rich. Judge everyone fairly. You should love your fellow as yourself. I am God. So there are many beautiful laws here. And so it's easy to say that when it says you should be holy, it's referring to the laws ahead. So there's the laws previously, and then there's the laws ahead. But Nachmanides, who was a famous commentator on the Bible and a Kabbalist, who lived in the 13th century in Barcelona in Spain, he gives a different explanation. He says that what it means that you should be holy is a law in itself. It's not a summary of the previous laws, like the passage before, as Rashi says. It's not an introduction to the following laws, which was another interpretation. He says it's a law all by itself. And what does this law mean? He phrases it in Hebrew, Kadesh atzmecha b'mutar lach. Sanctify yourself with that which is permitted. Now that's a very interesting concept. That means a thing might be permitted, and nonetheless, we are being told, sanctify yourself and don't indulge in something even if it's permitted. So for example, you can have permitted food, it's kosher, and so you're allowed to eat it. But nonetheless, don't overindulge in the food. Eat what you need to eat and don't be a glutton. And so with other aspects of life as well. And so this concept of sanctifying oneself with what is permitted, that is like an extra dimension in our observance of Jewish law. There's the laws of the Torah telling us this is permitted and this is forbidden. And then comes this extra concept that even in the things which are permitted, we exercise restraint and we're careful and we have a kind of a more sort of pure, I'm tempted to say the word ascetic, but it's not exactly asceticism, but it is a certain kind of restraint. So that is a way of understanding this verse. Now, the discourse that we're going to explore together with the help of Hashem is a discourse on this verse. And this theme that I've just been trying to explain is in the background to the discourse, and it comes up, and hopefully we will get as far as that in the actual discourse. But it's going to begin with a midrash on this verse, and it will present things in a slightly different way. So, have you been able to see what I'm reading?
No.
Oh, okay. You should have told me.
I can't. Maybe somebody else can, Rebbe.
All right. You should have mentioned. I'm sorry. I forgot to share the screen, and I was just reading. And I've suddenly realized that the screen wasn't shared. All right, I'm sorry. But so we're going to share the screen in a minute with the discourse. Oh, ya, 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 yo, ba-da, ba, ya, 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 yo, ba-bo. Ayom ba ya ya ba yom ba dom ho yedam ba yo yedam ba yom ba ho ya yedam ba yom ba yom ba yedam ba yom ba yom ha yedam ba ho yedam ba ho ha ya yedam ba ho ya yedam ba ho ya ya ho ya ya yo. Okay, so now I'm going to share the screen and see if I can find the right place, which I can't. So I'm going to have to try and find it again. One second. Right. Right. Okay, I believe. Can you see that?
No. Darkness.
It says it's loading. I don't know why it's taking so long. Sorry.
It's started to screen share.
Yes. It's moving very slowly.
Noch nicht.
It's telling me it's loading, but it's not yet loaded. And meanwhile, I'll just say hello to Eve and hello to Jeffrey.
Good evening, one and all.
Good evening.
Good Rebbe.
Maybe I should try and do it again. It doesn't normally take so long. Let me. It seems so frozen. Wait, I've just lost it again. Ah, okay, can you see it now?
Yes.
The discourse, good, all right. Right, so this is a discourse which was not edited by the Rebbe yet. The Rebbe said it and it was transcribed. He said it on Shabbat. And the brilliant people who were able to remember every word the Rebbe said, they, after Shabbat, they wrote it down. But the Rebbe never actually edited it for publication. But we have it here. And it was said in 1967 on Shabbat Kedoshim. Vayadaber, so it begins, as I read to you, unfortunately you weren't actually able to see it. God said, Kedoshim to you, you should be holy. Ki kadosh ani, because I am holy. Now the Midrash goes in a completely different direction to what words I was presenting before. The Itaba Midrash. Now the Midrash says, Kedoshim ti you, you should be holy. Yachol kamoni. Would you imagine that you can be as holy as I am, God? Of course not. Talmud Lomar, the Torah says, Ki kadosh ani, I am holy. Kedushatim lema'alam ikdushatchem. My holiness is higher than your holiness. In other words, you, we might understand the Midrash in this way, you endeavor to be holy, and you make some sort of progress in that, but God is infinitely holier. Now, before that, the Midrash gives a kind of what it calls a mashal, which one way of translating mashal is a parable. It's like a little story, a little narrative, and then we have to work out what that narrative means. And here it's going to work it out in a sort of spiritual way. Now, what is the mashal? What is the parable? Mashal livnei hamadina. There were the people in a certain country. Sha'asu shalosh atarot lamelech. They made three crowns for the king. And they gave the people in the country, they want to give a present to the king, they gave him three crowns. Now, these three crowns, they're three crowns representing the word kadosh, each one of them. Now, when do we have kadosh in a three? Three times kadosh.
It's in the prayer.
Yeshaya chapter 6, and then it's in the Siddur.
That's right. So it's there in the words of the prophets, and it's in our prayers. It's in the prayer before Kriyat Shema. We have the angels say, Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. And it's in Kedusha. We say, Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. And so that's what is meant over here by these three crowns. The angels make, the people of the country make three crowns. So the people of the country here, in a sense, that's the Jewish people. They make three crowns for God. That means they say this prayer, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. Me'asa ha-melech, what did the king do? Natan b'chosho achat, he put one crown on his own head. Ushtayim b'chosham shel banav. And two on the heads of its children. Now, it's actually interpreting this in a slightly different way to the way that I said it. Kach b'chol yom b'yom, thus every single day, ha'el yonim, the angels, machtirin lahakadosh baruch hu gimel kudusho. The angels crown God with three times holy, 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 holy. What does God do? Notem b'roshu achat, he puts one crown on his own head, so to speak. Ushtayim, and two of them, b'rosham shel Yisrael, on the head of the Jewish people. And that's why it says in our verse, speak to the community of the Jewish people and tell them you should be holy. V'hit kadishtem, you should make yourself holy. V'yitem kadoshim, and you will be holy. So this phrase, you should make yourselves holy and you will be holy, is somehow interpreted to mean that there are two aspects of holiness that come to the Jewish people, and there's one aspect of holiness which God retains. V'hainu, ma shekatuv ki kadosh ani, what it says, for I am holy, you should be holy because I am holy, that is talking about the crown which God puts on his own head, which is higher than the crowns which he puts on the heads of the Jewish people. Because for them, kadoshim to you, you should be holy, or these other phrases, they refer to the holiness of the Jewish people. And about this crown that God puts on his head, it says, kadosh, ki kadosh ani, for I am holy, kedushati lemaile mikdushatchem, my holiness is higher than yours. Now, so there we have this sort of interaction that is taking place between God and the Jewish people. We could say it's the Jewish people or the Jewish individual. And there is this interaction taking place. And the key concept in this interaction is holiness. And holiness means some sort of exalted level of spirituality. And it is this interchange that there is the holiness, the crowns put on the heads of the Jewish people and the crown which is put, so to speak, on the head of God. Now, it then says, it then comments on the word ki kadosh ani, I am holy. Kadosh bevav dafka. Now this word kadosh with the letter vav, holy. Now this level of holiness means with a vav indicates that the holiness, which in this case is the holiness of God, shenimshechet lamata, it flows below. And that's the idea of the letter vav in the word kadosh. It's talking about a flow downwards. God is exaltedly holy, but his holiness flows down to us. If it did not have a vav, the word kodesh, right? There's kadosh, which has got a vav. If you look at the word kadosh, then there's also a word kodesh. Now, kodesh is not written with a vav. It's got a cholem, which makes the same vowel sound, but it's just pronounced kodesh, and it is, it's not written with a vav. That is talking on the level of holiness, which is impossible to draw downwards. It's something which is absolutely beyond, and it's just holiness on a completely different plane.
Oh.
However, the holiness that's being spoken about here in this verse is kadosh with a vav, which indicates that this holiness of the divine, even though it is beyond us, it's somehow shared with us as well. Now, so, but that is a strange thing in terms of the Midrash, because the Midrash said that the crown that God puts on his own head, so to speak, right? Of course, this is an anthropomorphism, and God doesn't have any physical form, but it's talking in metaphorical, spiritual terms. So this crown that God puts on his head is the idea of a level of holiness which is very exalted. So how can it be? Why does it then speak about it with a vav, ki kadosh ani, that it's a level of holiness which is somehow shared with us? So here we are, we're groping in this world of holiness that God, the angels pronounce God holy with these three, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. And then God puts takes this crown, which expresses his exalted holiness, and gives us two crowns in some way. And even though his holiness is exalted beyond the world, beyond us, beyond the world, nonetheless, it's got a vav in it, which hints that it's going to be shared with us in some sense. Now, the whole discourse is about us reaching some kind of level of spirituality, going beyond the mitzvot. The mitzvot tell us what we can do and what we can't do. But by us exercising this concept that Nachmanides, Ramban, spoke about, of Kadesh Atzmecha B'Mutalach, sanctify yourself with what is permitted. In other words, we go to some extra level beyond what the Torah demands of us. That is a way that we can access the divine holiness, which is beyond the worlds. And that divine, that level, that exalted level of divine holiness, which relates to the essence of the divine, that then flows down to us. And it flows down to us at the most material level of our being, the most physical material level of our being, so that our lives become impregnated with holiness from the most exalted level. And nonetheless, it comes down, down, down to us in our earthly human form here in this physical world, as it is a physical world. We're not talking, the discourse is not talking about us ascending to some higher spiritual level. It's that us as real flesh and blood human beings are absorbed with an infinite boundless holiness sourced in the essence of the divine. And that level of the essence of the divine, it cannot be obscured. It is absolutely beyond any veil. And that is what is expressed by us here in this world through this very spiritual transaction, which is being described in the Midrash, and the interpretation of the Midrash with the crowns which are put on our head and the crown on God's head, and the way in which this is elucidated by the discourse. So that's the first page of the discourse. And he's now going to talk about the nature of existence. And this is a fascinating passage, and we're going to try and understand that together. However, let me pause at this. Oh, I'm not going to stop sharing, because it seems to be maybe the system is running very slowly, and it was quite a business to load up the sharing. So, but does anyone have any comment? Anyone have a comment? No, okay. So, paragraph 2, Bet. And to understand this, let's consider what the Rebbe, now this discourse was taught in 1967, shortly after Pesach, as we are. And during Pesach in 1967, the Rebbe said one or two discourses, and he's now referring back to one of those earlier discussions. And he's referring to a talk, a discourse by the Mittler Rebbe, the second Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rebbe Dobber, who explained a kind of contradiction that we find in Shah HaYichud V'Emunah. Shah HaYichud V'Emunah, Gate of Unity and Faith, is the second section of Tanya. It's a very beautiful section, and it talks about the nature of existence. One way of understanding what this is, it's a kind of a tract on contemplation, because by understanding the divine nature of existence and contemplating that, the person is able to get into a mood for a spiritual kind of prayer, so that when they ultimately say, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one," they can feel that in a particularly intense way, recognizing the oneness of the divine through all existence. And that's what this Gate of Unity and Faith is all about. In the very beginning, it mentions ways of thinking in the Shema, or thinking about God. And so there it says, now, so the second Lubavitcher Rebbe is commenting on two passages in this tract, Gate of Unity and Faith. In chapter 3 of this tract, it says, the 12th chapter, in chapter 3 it says that if the eye would be able to see the spiritual life force in everything, we would not see the physical dimension of things at all. It would not seem relevant. It would seem completely overcome, as it were, by the intense spirituality which is there. Now, we are not able to see it, so there's a concealment, so we're not able to see it. But if we could see it, we would only see that sort of spiritual reality. So everything that we see around us, you know, you're probably sitting in a room of some kind, unless you've managed to get a Zoom connection in a forest and the weather is suitable for that. But probably sitting in a room, you know, there's a table, there's chairs, there's walls, ceiling, the floor. All of that is really permeated by a divine life force, which is giving it existence. And if we were able to see the life force, we would see the divine life force. We wouldn't see the walls or the table or the ceiling. We would just see divine life force. Everything would be the, you know, bright colors of the divine, whatever colors they might be. And that's how we would see it. So that's what it says in chapter 3. But in chapter 4, it talks about two divine attributes. And one attribute is the attribute of chesed, which is an expression, chesed literally means kindness, which is a spreading out of life force through the whole of existence. And the second attribute is gibor, which is like gvura, severity, which is the power of God to conceal the life force so that the life force isn't seen, and instead you see the thing as something existing in itself. So in other words, it's not our power of sight which makes the difference. It's the divine quality which conceals the radiance, the life force in the table, let's say, so that we see a table, we see a physical table. But according to chapter four, there is actually the way in which this table is made is that there is a force of kindness which comes from God, chesed, which makes the table exist. And there's another power which comes from God, the quality of gvura, of severity, which hides the life force in the table. So how independently of whether we, which way we see. So it seems to be like it's a property of matter. It's a property of the table, that on the one hand, God makes the table exist, and at the same time, God makes the table be hidden from the life force of the table, hidden from our eyes. Now, the point is, do we think the table really exists? In a sense, does the table think it really exists? Or is it just a flow of life force from the divine? Is it a flow? So really, there's only God. There's nothing apart from God. Now, this is really what this tract, this 12-chapter tract, The Gate of Unity in Faith, is about, the issue of, is the world simply a sort of an expression of the divine, but there is nothing other than the divine? And if we only saw clearly, we would see Ein od milvado, there's nothing apart from him, nothing apart from God. Or is there actually a world? And the world is suffused with godliness, the world is kept in existence by godliness, the world is given life and energy by God, but there is a world. And this is described as two ways of seeing. One is called the upper unity, that all is one, all is God. And the other is called the lower unity, that God is all, that there is all, there is everything. There's the table and the tree and the house and the car and the tax form and the washing up, but it's all suffused with godliness, right? It's two ways of seeing. Now, he then compares this with the way you have to the idea of the sea and the dry land. Now, remember, we are coming after Pesach not long ago, and the seventh day of Pesach commemorated the crossing of the Red Sea. And what the crossing of the Red Sea means, Kabbalistically, is the splitting of the sea, that what was sea became dry land. Now, sea represents something hidden, something spiritually hidden. And when the sea split and the dry land was revealed, and the Israelites walked over the dry land, that means, from the Kabbalistic or Hasidic point of view, that something very exalted and hidden becomes revealed. And we're going to see that that is actually a process throughout the spiritual realms, that there are levels upon levels. There is a level which, a lower level, which is physical in relation to the higher level, and so which is spiritual. And the lower level is like dry land, and the spiritual is the sea. And then the sea splits, so to speak, and that level, which was sea, which was hidden, becomes revealed. And you have to go a level higher in order to discover the higher dimension, which is still hidden. And so it goes on up and up. That's how he's going to explain it. Now, all this brings out of the imagery about the splitting of the sea, which was a splitting of existence in such a way that the divine was revealed through the, you know, I'm tempted to say the cracks of existence, you know, like you've got existence as a kind of a veil, and then there are cracks in the veil, and you see a divine radiance which shines through those cracks, and then the veil is torn asunder, and suddenly the sea has changed into dry land. And that which was previously hidden is suddenly revealed in an incredibly way, in an incredible way. So that is the interplay. The interplay between these two attributes of kindness and severity, this interplay where the kindness is the revealing and the severity is the concealing. And so that's... and so as a result of that concealing, which comes about through the attribute severity, the world looks real, right? In other words, it makes this concealment of the divine. And as a result of the concealment of the divine, we see the world as a physical world. There are even people who believe that the physical world is the only reality. They don't believe it's called physicalism. It's got a name. Probably there are other names as well. People who think there's no soul, there's no spiritual this or that. All there is what you can see or measure. And that's the only reality.
Can I ask you something?
Yes.
If we're going by the analogy of the sea opening, we didn't do this for ourselves. It was a kind of gift.
That's a very good point. You're right. Part of the discussion of the discourse is the difference between a gift from above and something we do ourselves. That is a very good point. You're making a very good point, Eve.
So is he going to tell you how to do it yourself?
In a sense, yes, but... But the answer might seem very simple. The answer is through carrying out the mitzvot of the Torah. But it's when...
You started off saying this is beyond the mitzvot. So that's like the sort of basis for almost anything. Just do the mitzvot.
Well, you see, there's the mitzvot, and then there's sanctifying oneself beyond the mitzvot. So it's... particularly through that extra step of self-sanctification, that this level of the essence is revealed. And what it says about the essence being revealed is that it's revealed on every level. Instead of just going higher and higher, like a kind of a ladder where you go up to a higher rung and then up a higher rung, yet higher, yet higher. Here we're talking about some kind of transformation taking place from the very highest level to the very lowest level. And that is achieved, according to this discourse, not just by keeping the mitzvot, but in some sense, an extra step of self-sanctification within the mitzvot or beyond the mitzvot. And that idea, that way of understanding, you should be holy, that as Nachmanides puts it, be holy in those things that are permitted, that's the way we are able to transform our physical lives into channels for revealing the essence of the divine. Which is really an incredible concept.
Can I ask a question, please?
Yes.
So people who are idol worshippers, they make a pestle, you know, statue. Could it be that they see in it something beyond? I mean, can you excuse them thinking that they may see something there?
Well, certainly they see in the statue something spiritual. The Rambam, Maimonides, discusses in his Laws of Idolatry, Hilchot Avodah Zarah, Laws of Idolatry in his book Mishneh Torah. The first chapter discusses how idolatry began, because in terms of the Torah, it's very hard to understand how idolatry began. You've got God speaking to Adam and to Eve and to Noah. You know, where did idolatry come from? So he says that people at a certain stage, they realize that God is the source of all bounty, everything good, every blessing. But they felt, and maybe that's true, that God has different channels whereby he gives blessing to the world and the people in the world. Maybe one channel is for human fertility, another is for the crops, that the crops should be abundant. Another one is for safety at sea, let's say. So there are these different channels of blessing. And they all come from God. And at a certain stage, which the sages locate with the generation of Enosh, who was one of the generations in the Torah, that in the generation of Enosh, they began serving idols. And why? Because they said, you know, this channel of blessing, we should bring presents and we should praise this channel of blessing. And so they began making a temple to that channel of blessing. And they made a statue which represented that channel of blessing. And eventually they had a whole lot of different temples for different channels of blessing. And they forgot that there is the one power, the infinite oneness of God beyond all those channels. So they are not seeing the channels as drawing from a higher level. They just see them as a source of some kind of blessing here in the here and now. But they certainly saw them as having some kind of spiritual force. So they, as far as they were concerned, they weren't worshipping a dead statue. They thought the statue had spiritual power. So it's an interesting sort of philosophical question. What is better? Atheism, physicalism, let's say, which refuses to recognize any kind of spiritual power whatsoever, or idolatry, so, where the person attributes all kinds of spiritual power to this idolatrous tree or that idolatrous river. I have a friend, an old friend going back years, who was a completely, completely secular Israeli. And as a secular Israeli, he was a businessman and he came to India on business. He was buying ivory and selling it in Israel, making a lot of money out of it. And so he would come to, which might possibly be illegal, now, I don't know whether it was then. Anyway, he came to India and a man comes up to him in the street and says, I'll tell you your fortune, $100 a year. So he said, all right. He took out $100, gave it to the man. The man told him his fortune for the year ahead. So according to my friend, this prediction was completely accurate. I must say, he told it to me and he told me what happened. I couldn't see any correspondence whatsoever. But he saw it as a highly accurate prediction. This was the first time he was confronted with the idea of spirituality, because up to then he'd lived a completely, completely secular life. His father was an incredibly secular person, and that's how he'd been brought up. So the end of all that, he became a Braslav Chassid, And later on, he became a Chabad Hasid, and that's how I got to know him. But the beginning was what you might call an idolatrous or, you know, some kind of witchcraft. You know, I'll tell you your fortune, $100 a year. So it's an interesting question, you know, atheism or idolatry. So, and it could be that idolatry could lead a person to appreciating the spiritual, and then they go another step, and they realize the oneness of God. All right. So that's been a little bit of a diversion, but now we're going to come to an interesting question which this discourse asks, and let's just see if we're able to understand the question. We've been saying that it's the attribute of severity in the divine which produces the concealment so that we think the world is an independent world. In fact, it relates very much to that story of idolatry. They are seeing a channel of blessing as being something independent from God. Many of us, human beings, look at the physical world and, let's say, physicalism, atheism, see the world as a completely independent thing. And even if it's not with atheism, it could be with belief in God, we might see God and the world as totally separate. Yes, a person prays to God that everything should go well in the world and that God should organize the world in a positive way, that people should have life and sustenance and things should go well, there should be peace, there should be good things. But it's God organizing the world in this way or that way. It's not that the world itself expresses godliness, which is the truth according to Hasidic teaching. The world itself is an expression of godliness. The Baal Shem Tov spoke about this using a rather interesting image of a snail. Right, we're all aware of a snail, a little snail crawling around, and it's got a shell. Now, where does that shell come from? It's part of the snail. A baby snail doesn't have a shell. The shell slowly grows, it forms from the snail, and it then looks like an independent thing. In fact, the snail can die, and the shell is left. But that shell came from the snail. It's one thing together with it. So the Baal Shem Tov said, Tzimtzum, the concealment of God, which led to the existence of the world, the veiling of God, which led to the existence of the world, is like the shell of a snail. In other words, it's nothing different. So this is a beautiful perception. But for us, the physicality of existence is really only a gateway to the divine. Now, if you're going to think about it in that way, so I don't know what the proportions are in the world, you know, if you did some kind of questionnaire, right, or some kind of, you know, analysis, you know, how many people see, they look at a table, do they see with their mind's eye? Do they see that there's a spiritual life force in the table, or do they just see a table? And the way they look at the table might be very instrumental. They might think, you know, how much is this table worth? Do I want to have a table like this? Can I chop the table up for firewood? That's they're not thinking about godliness when they look at the table. So the question that's being asked in these lines, which are here on the screen, since it's true that everything is really godliness, and it explains this in terms of Shema Yisrael, hear O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And when we say one, Echad, the Ches has a numerical value 8, which means the seven firmaments and the earth, which means like above and below. The Dalad of the word Echad is 4, the 4 directions of the world, north, south, east, west. And they are all botel, they're all abnegated to the Aleph of Echad, which represents God, the master of the universe. So the true reality of the world is that everything is simply an expression of the divine. If that's the case, how is it possible that people think that there is a world without God? God forbid. They look at a world and they just see it as a physical world. And even a religious person who believes in God, he might see the world as very distinct from God. He doesn't see the godliness in existence. Now, so we've just explained that that comes because of this attribute severity. But how can the attribute severity present a false picture of the world? How can a divine attribute tend to us mistaking the nature of existence, right? That's the question that is asked here. And yes, someone wants to comment? Okay. That's the question which is asked. And the answer that he gives on line 19, the answer is that the wholeness of the divine, and he quotes a verse from the Zohar, a line from the Zohar, you are the wholeness of everything. The wholeness of the divine is in fact revealed in this attribute of severity more than in the attribute of kindness. The attribute of kindness seems to reveal God, but it only reveals God at a certain level. The level of God, the infinite levels which are beyond, that's not revealed by the power of Chesed. The power of Chesed reveals godliness on a certain level. The power of severity, which seemingly conceals godliness, actually relates to a much higher aspect of godliness. And it relates to the essence of the divine. And so the very power which conceals that we can't see the godliness in the table is actually the power which potentially gives us access not just to a spiritual life force which is in the table, but to the essence which is beyond everything and within everything. Now, let me try to explain the way that I understand it, the limited way that I understand it. If we imagine a wonderful painter, an artist, like, let's say, Van Gogh. Now, my opinion of Van Gogh is that he had a very deeply spiritual perception, and that perception was extremely intense. And as a man, he found it very hard to contain that intensity. And as a result, he had a very difficult and tragic life. Now, but that doesn't take away from the reality of what he was seeing. When he painted a cornfield or a stool in a cottage, that stool, that cornfield had in the painting has a tremendous spiritual energy. Now that spiritual energy is really something that all of us might be able to see, hopefully with more vessels. You see, the Kabbalah talks about radiance and vessel. So when the radiance is very intense, then and the vessel is in some way incomplete, then the vessel might break. It shatters. And you have this Kabbalistic concept, the shattering of the vessels, which is an idea that relates quite closely to people going through extremes of feeling and of perception, which lead to states which person might call psychosis, nervous breakdown, because the vessels are not strong enough, or it's not necessarily a matter of strength. Hasidic teachings point out it's a matter of them being interconnected. if the vessels are interconnected, then they're able to bear much greater intensity of radiance, of flow. But if the vessel just stands by itself and it's not connected with anything, then there's nowhere for the energy to flow. And when the energy goes into the vessel, if it's too strong, then it breaks the vessel. So all that could be understood in a psychological way as well as the Kabbalistic Hasidic way. So that perception of the energy in the wicker chair, the straw chair, I'm thinking of a particular painting, like in a cottage, a chair, and of a cornfield, right? These are, I'm sure you're familiar, some of you familiar with these paintings. So that energy, that is a certain level of energy. But there is a higher dimension. There's the essence of the divine, which is much higher than the energy which radiates in the cornfield and can be in some sense expressed by Van Gogh. Incidentally, just going back to the idea of painting, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, writing to certain artists, said this is the function of art. Art should be revealing the spiritual energy in existence. So that's an aside, you know, that's what art is supposed to be. But that's still not the highest level of spiritual energy. The highest level of spiritual energy relates to the very essence of the divine. And the way in which that is revealed is by the attribute severity, not kindness, but severity, which hides and which seemingly conceals any kind of spirituality, so that we got a world with a large proportion of people who believe in physicalism, who are atheists, who don't believe in God, don't believe in spiritual anything. If they listen to what we were talking about now, they think it's nonsense. What are you talking about? All you can do with the table is measure its atoms and molecules, and it's made of carbon, and that's it. There's no other reality. That concealment is actually the gateway to the table expressing the essence of the divine. So there might be some kind of parallel in modern science, you know, with antimatter, dark holes, different kinds of concepts which have emerged. But this power to conceal is at the same time a power to reveal on a completely higher level. And so therefore we've got the idea that physical existence itself is an expression of ultimate existence of the divine. And Rivka, this perception, you know, if an idolater, you know, heard this, you know, he'd say, oh, well, you know, so let's worship the statue. Of course not, God forbid, because the object is something which reveals the essence of the divine. Now, the point here is it's revealing it as an object, as a physical object here in this world, because the whole tension which is in this discourse, which, you know, it's a long discourse, and we're not going to, you know, I'm trying to communicate my way of understanding the discourse, having learned it this afternoon, learned it some years ago. We had it earlier in one of our Aleph groups together years back, 2014, we learned it. So that's 9 years ago. And there's probably a recording of our discussion of it on the Chabad Research website from 9 years ago. But this, it's an amazing teaching that it's the very concealment that is the gateway to this intense revelation. In other words, the fact of something existing, why does it exist? because God is the ultimate existence. That's what God is. God is Yesh HaAmiti, the true existence. Everything else in relation to God is on a lower level of existence. In fact, the Rambam, just the last couple of days, yesterday and today, the last 3 days, we have begun studying the Rambam afresh. There's a worldwide movement generated by the Rebbe in 1984 that people should study Rambam every day. And we're just coming to the beginning of, I think it's the 43rd cycle. I'm not quite clear. How many cycles? So this, one second. It's now beginning the 43rd cycle. So I have here the the little calendar for the whole year. How it works. Now, there the Rambam says that the basis of all, the foundation of all foundations and the pillar of all wisdom is to know, and it's interesting, he says to know, not to believe, but to know, that there is a Motsui Rishon, a first existence, which is the key to all other existence in the universe. And he says, if you would imagine that key existence, which is God, of course, if you would imagine that key existence wasn't there, nothing else would be there at all. Because God is the essence, the reality of everything. And if you imagine that there was no universe, then there would simply be that essence all by itself. There would be God alone. So that's how he begins in the first few paragraphs. A very beautiful thing. That's Mishneh Torah, which can be accessed on Chabad.org. It's got the whole thing with an English translation. So it's a very profound text. Now, what this discourse is saying is that it's the existence of God, that word existence, being, that existence of God which lends itself to all other existence. And everything that exists takes its being from godliness, from the existence of God. And that fact about existence is totally obscure, because most people, either they are unspiritual people, so they only see the physical thing and it can be chopped up for firewood, or it can be sold, or it can be stolen, or whatever, but it hasn't got anything to do with God as far as they're concerned. Or you have spiritual people who might be someone like Van Gogh, who paints a beautiful picture and showing you the radiance which is there in the cornfield or the chair. Or he might be a contemplating Hasidic figure, man or woman, looking at the table and seeing the godliness in it and being inspired by that sense of godliness, even though it's a simple wooden table. And then there's the level beyond, which is the essence of the divine, which is on a completely different level. And what the discourse is saying, that first of all, by us keeping the mitzvah of the Torah, which somehow align our physicality with these sort of metaphysical structures, and then making that extra step of sanctify yourself in that which is permitted, beyond the Torah, a little step beyond the Torah, what you might call the Hasidic dimension, right? The Hasidim do a little bit more. That's what the Hasidic movement was supposed to be about in some way. That's how it's envisioned by the Rebbe, for example. That's he sees the Hasidim, they're a little bit more strict about this and a little bit more strict about that. Which of course being strict might lead to other problems, so you got to deal with that as well. You got to be a nice person together with it. But a normal person, but it's that step beyond which opens the channel so that one can look at the table and be aware that this is an expression of the essence of the divine. And not only the table, everything around one and one's own self, one's own being and everyone around one. And if you look at the world like that, that's the way the world will look in the time of Mashiach. The world is an expression of the essence of the divine. How would anyone dream of carrying out a crime, God forbid, or war? Of course, that wouldn't be there. The world, the time of Mashiach, is a time of total universal peace and goodness tangibly expressed. Because every step is a step which is an expression of the divine essence. Well, what I've tried to do, maybe it only gets, 3 out of 10 or something, is summarize this discourse, which is, it's a long discourse and it's very subtle discourse. But what I've tried to do is express what it is saying. Does anyone have any comments? Maybe I'll risk stop sharing and so we can just see if anyone has any comment on this so far.
Can I elaborate on the statue thing which I started before, after what you said just now? So if you see two statues, one of them is not worshipped, just statue as it is, and the other one being worshipped. So the one that is worshipped, there is a bit of revealment there. And the one that is not worshipped is a result of concealment, is a gevura. The other one is more chesed. So the idol is more chesed a little bit there than the other one. Is it true?
Do you understand? Well, the problem is, Rivka, if the statue is being worshipped as an idol.
Only one of them. There are two of them.
Yeah, but let's look at that one. The one that's being worshipped as an idol is a blockage in the path to God. Because the fact of the person worshipping that as an idol means that they are taking that instead of God.
Yeah.
And that is a serious problem. So what it's revealing is something very dangerous. There can be, we have the whole concept of revelation and concealment. And, maybe relating to the concept of modesty and womanhood. So there's revelation, which can be the very opposite of good. And in spiritual terms, that idol, which is showing some kind of glow in the eyes of its worshippers, that glow is very problematic. It's the wrong glow. It's a glow which doesn't lead to God. It separates the person from God. So in Hasidic texts, it talks about two kinds of mamutsa. A mamutsa, Rivka understands the word, and I'll just tell everyone else, mamutsa means an intermediary. And of course, Eve understood. A mumutsa is a mumutsa is an intermediary. And there are two kinds of intermediary. There's mumutsa hamafrid, the intermediary which separates you from the thing that you're supposed to be connecting to, God. And there's the mumutsa hamachaber. There's the intermediary which joins you to God. Now, the Torah scroll, for example, is something which is very holy and it's taken out of the ark and people kiss it and it's very special, and we look at it with great reverence, but it's not an idol. The Torah scroll connects us to the divine who wrote the Torah. But an idol is something which separate, according to Jewish teaching, right, separates the person from God. They kiss the idol or they worship the idol in some way, whether it's bringing an offering to the idol or some other activity, bringing food to the idol. And that is separating them from the awareness of the divine. That's how Maimonides puts it. And that's how general Jewish teaching looks at it.
They were talking about two. One of them that you just described, but so another one, which is a statue without any investment of. So this is much more spiritual, what you said, because it's.
But it's spirituality. It's like a naked woman. You know, it's spirituality the wrong way.
It wasn't worshipped. So you said that every item, every object has got spirituality in it. But the Gevura.
Yes, but the question is, where does that spirituality lead you? Does the spirituality lead you to holiness, or does it lead you to unholiness? In the view of the sages and the Torah itself, idolatry led to things like burning of children to the idol. It led to immorality of various kinds. There were the women in the idolatrous temples that the people would come and have intercourse with those women. It was all seen as something which was negative and immoral in the way in which the Bible looks at it, the Torah, with its constant war against idolatry, and the Rambam as well. The Rambam sees idolatry as a major, major issue. And indeed, Jewish thought all the way through the ages does. And so when we discuss the delicate point, which it's a very reasonable point that you're making, that the idolater looking at his idol or her idol sees it as very spiritual. So isn't that better in some way than the second statue that no one worships, right? The first statue is an idol recognized by thousands of people, and the second statue is just a statue which is for sale. It's nothing. It doesn't have the same power. But what I'm trying to express here is that the idol, it's a diversion of spirituality. It expresses something spiritual, but it's diverting it the wrong way. Okay.
I'm against it myself. I'm not authorizing or really agreeing with it. I'm just saying that the concept of some people towards it, but also the question was about the other one, which maybe because you say every chair, the other statue is like a chair, like anything. So in that sense, it's a gevura, it is a hidden thing. But it looks like that's what I'm trying to say, that it's even higher level, higher than the idol.
Yes, it is.
The problem is, in other words, that en lo guf. So in a sense, you're likely to get trapped into things which aren't just idols. I mean, if you really follow the en lo guf idea, it kind of blows you away.
Right.
Right, so anything can turn into...
Translate, Eve.
An idol. Sorry?
Translate the words, ain't no good.
Well, there's no material body to Hashem.
That's right. Go on.
So anything with a material body, whether it's an idol or, as this lady said, a chair, can be misleading in that way. That's why it's such a big problem. Because the concealment is the idol. Almost anything is an idol.
Right, right. Well, except if we see it as a channel or a way of revealing the oneness of the infinite oneness of the essence of the divine. Now, that's a very subtle thing. And
That was the lady's problem. I mean, that was what the lady's saying, you know. I mean, if you move it away from the statue and, you know, sort of art versus worship, where it seems clear enough, to this other thing, which is what I think she was suggesting with the chair, then it becomes really sticky. Right? Because you're saying is that if it's a medium, if it's a form of mediation, then it's okay, but it's not okay, really.
I'm repeating what Dr. Loventhal said, that the physical objects have some gvura in them with the concealment, and they have some kind of hidden spirituality. That's what I'm saying.
It's a very subtle thing. Spinoza spoke about the world as being God. Nature is God. And so that is called pantheism. The pan, which means everything, is theos, is God. And then comes the question of how is that, what do you say, Eve?
Sorry, nothing. Go ahead.
Yeah. So then comes the question. So there was a rabbi in England in the 18th century, David Nieto. And he gave a talk saying that when the wind blows, it's godliness. The wind is an expression of God blowing the wind. And the people in his community were scandalized. They thought this sounded like Spinoza. And the Gaboim of the synagogue, or someone, wrote to a famous rabbi in Europe, the Chacham Tzvi, asking him, is this heretical? Is this Spinozaism? And the rabbi wrote back and he said, no, it's perfectly right. It's true that, you know, God is expressed in nature. So the difference, one way of understanding the difference between this sort of mystical perception of God and nature, and the difference from that, from Spinoza, is that Spinoza is pantheism, and Hasidic teachings, or spiritual teachings, Jewish spiritual teachings, are panentheism. Everything is within God. So everything is within God. So everything is permeated by godliness, but God is still infinitely beyond everything as well. And it was that beyond that Spinoza didn't have. And so there's the beyond, the level of God totally beyond. And then God permeates everything through this particular way of perceiving existence, that all the very fact of existing is an expression of the divine existence. All right, listen, we've used up our time, and thank you very much for sharing in this little exploration, which I tried to present. I didn't plan to do it this way, but try to present a kind of summary of what this long discourse is saying, which is indeed a very profound statement and easy to misunderstand, maybe. But
you did a great job, Tali.
Thank you very much. It was really great.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. All the very best to all of you. And
all the best. God bless.
Wishing you a wonderful Shabbat and later on this week. And to see you next Tuesday with the help of God.
Have you got a minute for me?
Right.